before we cut our cords, and streaming was years away. You could only binge on old DVDs, and seasons didn't last one day. But how did we cope? The weekly wait was such a tease. With the 2-hour block of shows, we could endure with ease. On every Thursday, could tune into NBC. Travel to Dundee, Mifflin, Greendale, TGS, San Pawnee. They stopped calling him a sea, but it was still a beautiful sight. So now I'm talking Comedy Night, and it's podcasted right.
Welcome back to Comedy Night, podcasted right. From New Brunswick, Canada, please welcome Matt the Machine Kale. You can just picture me doing a twirl in your mind. Today, I am continuing my look back through that wild and wonderful time that was the 2009-2010 network television season, when Community, Parks and Recreation, The Office, and 30 Rock aired new episodes in one amazing 2-hour block of television. Whether you're a fan of one of these shows or a fan of all four, my hope is that you will enjoy this podcast. And maybe it'll encourage you to check out the other series. Going back and watching four different series at once brings back the charm that they had when they first aired, and how they played off each other so well. So far, I've been finding all sorts of connection between the shows, and tonight, there is one connection they made on purpose. We are going way back to November 19th, 2009, which fell during NBC's annual Green Week campaign, and we'll be looking at Community Season 1, Episode 10, Environmental Science, Parks and Recreation Season 2, Episode 10, The Hunting Trip, The Office Season 6, Episode 11, Shareholder Meeting, and 30 Rock Season 4, Episode 6, Sun Tea. Green Week was, and I believe they're still doing it, a week where all NBC programming tries to promote environmentally friendly messages. I don't understand why they do this in November instead of April to coincide with Earth Day, but listen, I don't need to explain to you how hard they force this idea. These shows are going to do it all for themselves.
This is the Comedy Night Podcasted Right Olds. If it was new, we call it news, but it's old, so we call it olds.
In today's old news, on November 19, 2009, the New York Times broke the story that Oprah Winfrey would be ending her daytime talk show in May of 2011, after 25 years on the air. Considering the show debuted only weeks before I was born, I've grown up with Oprah being a constant presence on TV in my house. By nothing more than sheer dumb luck, I caught some of the biggest moments the first time they happened. For example, I watched live the infamous 2005 episode where Tom Cruise jumped on Oprah's couch and declared his love for Katie Holmes, which was weird enough on his own, but then he ran around backstage to try and find her. It was pretty friggin' awkward, considering that he was there to promote the sci-fi action movie War of the Worlds. Cultural landmarks aside, ugh, this show. I've got a lot of grievances with the kind of nonsense that the Oprah Winfrey Show unleashed on the world. We're still putting up with Dr. Phil and Dr. Oz because of this show. And how much of a boost did anti-vaxxers get when Oprah gave Jenny McCarthy a platform to spew her nonsense on the show? Or, in less innocuous bullshit, she created several fake moral panics. Like back in 2003, when she did a special about the completely made-up concept of teenager rainbow parties, which led to a lot of us teenagers having to have very awkward conversations with our moms. But the Oprah Winfrey Show, for better or worse, was an enduring part of the cultural zeitgeist for decades. So instead of editorializing more, here's some general connections between Comedy Night done right and Oprah. Her name gets dropped a lot. Here's just a smattering of clips. It certainly is not comprehensive, but it should give you some idea of the impact she had. Winfrey had a distinct way of delivering exciting news that is instantly recognizable, whether it be her massive favorite things giveaways or just her general enthusiasm. When the study group is forced to perform as celebrity impersonators in Community's Contemporary Impressionists, we get to see Shirley play Oprah, and she is perfect.
Hello, everyone. It is my honor and privilege as fake Oprah Winfrey to present the night's final award. Most handsome young man. Aww. And the winner is... Howie Schwartz!
I'll at least give Oprah credit where credit is due and talk about the massive influence her book club had, since, at the very least, it got people to buy books. There was controversy around one selection, James Frey's A Million Little Pieces, which was promoted as a memoir about drug addiction, but turned out to be mostly untrue, and it led to one of the greatest episodes of South Park, A Million Little Fibers. But it also inspired the Season 3 Parks and Rec episode, Born and Raised, when Leslie's trying to promote her own book using Joan Calamezzo, Pawnee's resident talk show host and trendsetter, who has her own influential book club.
The Time Traveler's Optometrist by Pawnee's own Penelope Foster. A heartwarming story about a caveman eye doctor who travels to present-day Cincinnati and can see everything but love. Unreadable. Then, Joan slaps her sticker on it, bestseller 4 years in a row.
It wasn't all books, moral panics, and celebrities on the brink of insanity. Winfrey also opened the Oprah Winfrey Leadership Academy for Girls in South Africa in 2007 to help disadvantaged girls get an education. As with everything, it has had its share of criticisms, but I'm not educated enough on the subject to comment on it. I really only bring it up since I haven't had the opportunity to use a Robert California drop yet on this show.
Oprah Winfrey's Leadership Academy and other schools like it, while wonderful, end with high school. I want to see these girls right through college, especially the gymnasts. They've lost so many years of crucial education to perfecting their bodies. Muscle groups the rest of us can't even fathom.
Gymnasts. You're going to seek out uneducated gymnasts.
Yes.
And let's not forget that Winfrey herself guest starred on 30 Rock in Season 3's Believe in the Stars. I could have probably done an entire section on the times that 30 Rock mentioned Oprah by name, but I'll narrow it down to the one time she appeared on screen. And I said a few months back in my first episode that I wasn't sure if I'd ever rewatch this specific episode, as it was one of the several that were removed from streaming due to the use of blackface. Well, I finally decided now was as good of time as any. Liz meets Oprah on a flight from Chicago to New York.
I want to help you. What can I do?
Oh my God, would you say, please welcome Liz Lemon?
No, but here is what I will do. While I'm in New York, if you want, I can stop by and I can talk to Tracy and Jenna.
But Liz was just impaired due to wine and in-flight medications, and she actually met a tween named Pam, who despite not being Oprah, was able to get the actors to stop fighting. Controversy aside, the episode is a time capsule of the effect that Oprah had, for better or worse. Millions looked up to her for sage advice. Some of it was good, sometimes, well, just skip back and listen to the last few minutes again. She was part of pop culture in and of itself, and with her show ending, we thought it was the end of an era. I mean, in a way it was, but she's still out there getting high-profile interviews and still making an impact. So I guess the lesson that I'm going to beat to death out of this week's The Olds is that just because you think something is over, doesn't mean it's going away.
This is what everyone watched instead.
Going green, despite all of the advertising they pumped into this campaign, did nothing for ratings. In fact, it was worse than nothing since they dropped. Community failed to break 5 million for the first time, only getting 4.9 million viewers this week. Parks stayed flat at 4.6 million. The Office had a pretty significant drop from 8 million down to 7.4, and 30 Rock fell down to 5.7 million, its first time below 6 million this season. The Jay Leno Show, somehow, got 4.8 million for the third week in a row. His guests included Dakota Fanning, who was also in War of the Worlds when she was 11, and even she wasn't jumping on furniture to promote it. But she's here tonight to plug Twilight New Moon, which was coming out this weekend. He also had Jeff Dunham on the show, who got fired by Jack Donaghy 3 weeks ago, and he's only 2 weeks away from having his own Comedy Central show get canceled. And The Office's Kate Flannery played Mother Earth in some sort of sketch, of which only a few pictures survive on the internet, but I'm guessing it was a tie-in for all of this Green Week nonsense. But at least viewership was down across the board, with pretty much every network seeing the ratings go down since last week. On Fox, Bones finished in second place at 8 o'clock, with 9.9 million tuning into The Foot in the Foreclosure, where a human foot and a pile of ashes are found in the bed of a house that's for sale.
I burned my foot!
While Fringe managed to beat 30 Rock with 5.9 million viewers for August, with a way too convoluted plot to summarize, but I'm pretty sure it was something about time travel.
You're not sideways, Jack.
I'm past Jack because I'm from the past and I'm you.
Yeah, I get it.
On ABC, Flash Forward is hanging on with 8 million viewers at 8 o'clock with Believe, where, amongst 90 other things that happen, Kiko gets a tattoo.
I hit the corner right on a fresh tattoo.
Grey's Anatomy had 14.1 million viewers at 9, with Holidays, an episode that spans Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, as this was the last new episode of Grey's in 2009.
You guys, this is the best Breakfast Day, Waffle Day joint present I have ever received.
And Private Practice had 8.9 million viewers at 10, with Sins of the Father, featuring guest star Wayne Wilderson, who played Martin for two episodes on The Office back in season 3.
Martin went from being a new guy from Stanford to the convict, to my friend. Back to a convict. Then to kind of a nuisance, actually, if we can be completely honest. And finally to a quitter.
CBS crushes all competition yet again, with Survivor getting 12.3 million viewers. Again, the plot summaries for everything are completely incomprehensible, but somehow Russell got to use his cell phone on the island.
I tell you what, NSYNC, you want to learn about life? Give up the phone.
Oh.
On CSI, 14.9 million tuned into Lover's Lane, where the team investigates a severed head found inside a bowling ball during a championship match.
Wham! His kappa is detached from his head.
And the most viewed show tonight was The Mentalist, with 15.9 viewers at 10 o'clock, tuning into His Red Right Hand, with the team reeling after serial killer Red John attacks the CBI.
There's been 10 assaults already this year!
Wow, really? Can't you station a park ranger out here?
We have! Who do you think they're assaulting?
And once again, I can't find the ratings for FX, but at 10, Always Sunny aired another instant classic with The Dennis System, featuring Glenn Howerton's real-life wife, Jill Latiano, playing the Dennis System's victim, Kaylee.
And then, naturally, we bang.
Jill will appear later this season in Community's Physical Education, playing Jeff's classmate, Courtney. So we'll talk about her more when we get to that episode. At 10:30, the league aired Mr. McGiblets, featuring guest star Will McLaughlin as a neighborhood patrolman.
2046 calling in. I got some sort of upright birthday mask on. He's exiting a house carrying his satchel. I don't know what this is, but I'm gonna find out.
And he'll go on to make 7 appearances on Parks and Recreation as Officer Randy Kilnose. So, Oprah's retiring, it's Green Week, and the ratings still suck. Let's see how I can weave this mess all together.
For we caught up cold and streaming was years away. We only binge on old DVDs and seasoned in last Monday. Stop going in my seat, it was still a beautiful sight. Now I'm talking comedy now, and it's podcasting right.
Environmental Science was directed by Seth Gordon, his one and only Community directing credit, which led me to racking my brain, trying to figure out why his name sounded so familiar, only to realize that he directed The Office's Double Date only 2 weeks ago. This episode was written by Zach Paez, his first of 2 Community writing credits. A few weeks ago, when NBC was pushing volunteerism on all their shows, Community did not complete the assignment, likely because those early episodes of Community aired completely out of order. But the message comes through loud and clear at the start of the episode that it's Green Week, and that the dean, to help be more Earth smart, is changing the school's name to Envirodale.
But we're already called Greendale!
It's enough to make you think we're going to get a dean episode, but the only development we get out of him this week is the beginning of his Dalmatian fetish. So forget that and get ready for a Chang-up. Senor Chang's been laying low for several episodes now, and today, in Spanish, he's mailing it in, laying with his head down while the class writes a test. Annie won't quit writing, even after time's up, and Chang snaps and drags her, desk and all, into the hallway, An escalation of events leads to the entire class being forced to write a 20-page essay due on Monday. Quite the challenge.
This is Spanish 101. I know how to say hello tomorrow, and that tables are female. That's the only Spanish you taught us.
Oh!
Also, environmental sustainability be damned. That's a lot of paper they're going to waste. Annie tries to report Chang to the dean, but he's irreplaceable since no one else wants to teach Spanish. It's a throwaway joke, but remember this 5 or 6 months from now. As for Annie and Britta, neither of them have much more to do with the plot, other than reacting to what's going on around them. If there's any sexual tension between them and Jeff, it's not showing here. These love arcs are like Oprah at this point. Who knows when they'll be back. The rest of the study group can't handle the extra workload that Chang has dropped on them, except Jeff, who's just trying to C-grade his way through this degree. They all want Jeff to try to talk some sense into Chang. Jeff tries to lawyer his way out. How can he convince Chang to do anything if he can't even convince his friends that he shouldn't talk to Chang? It almost works, but it backfires.
Wait, you are convincing!
Jeff is given the ultimatum that if he can't stop Chang, the study group won't help him anymore. If you haven't caught on yet that my recaps of Community are not in chronological order, congratulations. But trying to condense a pretty dense plot goes a lot quicker when I follow the individual threads from start to finish. So Shirley doesn't have time for the Spanish essay because she's working on a marketing presentation. But she gets way too sweaty and nervous when public speaking, so she's already a wreck. Pierce offers to help, and that's tonight's C-plot. Even for a Pierce helps someone C-plot, it's a little thin. We get one scene of Pierce helping Shirley, who's trying to fuse the internet with brownies, and Pierce does have some good tips. Don't read from cue cards, which I guess is an eco-friendly choice. Wear a darker top to hide sweat stains. Don't lock your knees. Pantomime handing out sandwiches when driving your point home. And drop in some attention-grabbing words.
A multiple orgasm.
He also berates her on using filler words. Pro tip, Shirley. Best way to get rid of filler words is to, like, edit them out afterwards? I'll just wind to the end here. She starts her speech reading from cue cards, and then, seeing Pierce eating a sandwich, takes his advice and delivers what we assume is a great marketing presentation. It's something for these two to do, but unlike previous weeks, it doesn't play much into the rest of the episode. The same can be said about our B-plot. Troy and Abed are 3 days behind on their biology lab, where they're experimenting on rats to get them to respond to a specific song, which feels much more like a psychology experiment to me. They're behind because Troy's afraid of rats.
I'm not afraid, Abed. I choose not to be around rats because they are unpopular. Same goes for centipedes and lakes.
Troy's annoyed that Abed insisted they sing a duet, Somewhere Out There from an American Tale. Abed's even named the rat Fievel. Troy, freaked out by another rat, knocks over Fievel's cage and he escapes, leading to Abed adorably going around the school, singing to the rat to try to get him back. Abed gets about as upset as we ever see him get because Troy refuses to help him, even when it's now a life or death situation because the dean's bringing in an exterminator. Troy's perception of friendship is still skewed from years of being popular in high school, and he believes that friendship just means that people do things for him. This stress is all exasperated by Jeff trying to fix the Chang situation. Jeff uses his jury selection skills to deduce that Chang's wife has left him. So Jeff hatches a plan. He implies that he would hang out with Chang to help distract him, but he can't because he's got all this homework. It almost works too easily, except Chang doesn't cancel the entire essay. He gives Jeff and only Jeff a pass. As Jeff mulls over his own good versus the good of the group, Abed pops in looking for Fievel.
Is there a rat in here?
Jeff indeed plays the rat. Chang has become straight up abusive in class, and then dumps a quiz on top of the essay. When Chang and Jeff are seen together chumming it up after class, the rest of the study group calls Jeff out.
You devious clump of overpriced fabric and hair product.
Speaking as one of the meek, as soon as I'm here to Earth, you a dead man.
You got a weird forehead.
Jeff and the study group exchange fake, then real outrage with each other. But Jeff's only goal here is to pass Spanish, so he quits the group and continues to hang out with Chang. But even after laughing over essays together, Chang breaks down over being so lonely that his wife has left. Everything comes to a head during the Green Day concert at the end of the week,
By the way, they're not the real Green Day. Thought we should just rip that band-aid off quickly.
Chang threatens to fail Jeff as well, but Jeff's invited Senora Chang to the concert, and the two reconcile through the power of salsa dance. Meanwhile, Troy overcomes his fear of rats to help Abed coax Fievel out of a vent by singing the duet, while Green Day is playing in the background. All is well as Fievel responds to his training, and he runs out of the vent and up Troy's pant leg.
Disgusting!
Thank you.
At the concert, Chang takes a stage and thanks Jeff for helping fix his marriage, but then calls him out for taking advantage of the situation. However, the essays have been canceled and Jeff reconciles with the study group. This is a fun episode, but I found it a little lacking after the strength of the episodes over the last few weeks. But overall, despite the intentions for this to be an episode with a green message, it's really a story about friendship. We're still witnessing the earliest version of Pierce. The Pierce who's been at Greendale for years and has almost no friends to show for it. He's constantly offering to help the other members of the study group, and all he ever really wants in return is friendship, for someone to laugh at his jokes. The Troy and Abed storyline is really kind of sweet, and Troy finally coming to his senses to help Abed is a great moment, but when he's explaining friendship earlier in the episode, it feels like he's really regressed from the growth we've already seen. Jeff has regressed a lot as well, being a real dick about everything at the start. Although, to be honest, Jeff always does everything kind of begrudgingly, but it feels like it takes a lot longer for him to come around to the plan in this episode. And to be fair, his mission is to deal with Chang. And Chang's just not hitting the right notes for me tonight either. I find the humor comes best when he's pathetic and has an inflated and unearned confidence. I don't know, maybe he's just got too much power in this situation here. Ultimately, the plot's a little muddled, and it all just gets smushed together at the end. And it doesn't feel like we've added anything to what we've built upon over the last few weeks. It's almost as if this episode should have come several weeks ago, as all the characters have taken a step back in their development. And from here, it's a little bit difficult to tell where the show is heading. Not that it's necessarily a bad thing to have a break from all the sexual tension storylines, but this just kind of sticks out. Just like Oprah's next move after she ends her show, we're left guessing as to what will happen next. But at the very least, one thing is clear. This is a show about friendships. Community gets to flex that differently than the other series, which are all workplace comedies. Even if we have a common thread of people being in places they don't want to be, college is so much different than a job. Companies have to teach employees constantly on how to get along with each other. But in school, you can either take your classes alone, or you can find your people to help you get through to the end. It's a much more organic experience. Organic, Green Week. Folks, I'm killing it this week. The Hunting Trip was directed by Greg Daniels, a name we all know by now. But he also directed The Office's Murder last week. I love finding these little connections while looking at the original air dates, since these are lost to us now in the streaming age. Since now we've seen the last two Office directors direct two different shows tonight. This was Daniels' second of three directing credits on Parks. This episode was written by Dan Gore and is the second of his 10 writing credits on Parks. Or technically, Daniel J. Gore, as he's credited here. Gore, who's not a doctor, went on to also direct two episodes of Parks, and he's tucked away in the background of the office's threat level Midnight while they're all dancing the Skarn. And probably most notably, he co-created Brooklyn Nine-Nine with Parks' co-creator, Michael Schur. Jay Johnston appears in this episode as the Park Ranger. He's been in tons of great stuff, and he'll eventually play a cop on Community's The Science of Illusion later this season. Being Green Week, the Pawnee Parks Department is going to get up close and personal with nature by killing some of it. This weekend is Ron's annual trail survey, where he takes Brandanowitz and Jerry out to a hunting lodge, the park ranger's own. Leslie, rightfully, calls this out for being a boy strip. Ron's own excitement turns on him, since he's listening to turkey calls in his office and he can't deny what he's doing.
Is this not rap?
So Ron's hands are tied. He's been calling this a work event, so he's forced to bring Leslie, Donna, Anne, and Tom along with him for the weekend. Everyone else is excited just for the trip, but Leslie is desperate to impress Ron. And let me just put a disclaimer out here that Leslie is 100% justified in her motivations here. While we're getting almost no lesson in nature conservation or recycling or anything else about being green, this silly little story is endemic for women in all sorts of careers. So while I'm about to describe Leslie as being a pest, it's only because she starts out as being super awkward. Her modus operandi is summed up thusly.
Guys love it when you can show them you're better than they are at something they love.
Touché, Ms. Nope. Meanwhile, Tom's the real punching bag in this episode. He gets pantsed by Leslie, and then he swallows some chewing tobacco, which even Leslie knows.
Why do they call it chew and not swallow? Am I right, Ron?
Yes, you are right.
Somehow, avid woodsman Ron agrees to let all these people go into the forest with guns after drinking beer and only about 2 seconds of safety training. Although, he himself was distracted that Leslie's toast to the hunt was much more well-received than his own.
Ron, your toast sucked.
We learn that even Jerry seems to be more at home in the woods, as he gets the first kill. Maybe it's because...
This trip, it is the one time of year I get to pee standing up.
Leslie manages to shoot a quail before Ron can get anything, and that sets off a competition to see who can out-hunt the other. I'm not a hunter, and definitely not a gun person. So things feel a little tight in the chest as everyone's just walking around in the woods and firing guns off in every direction. And it's just a matter of time before someone gets hurt, and it's Ron, who's been shot in the back of the head. The same shot also takes out a window and tire of Donna's Mercedes, and I can't tell if it's Donna or Ron who's more upset. Ron, shockingly, doesn't appreciate that he's been shot in the head.
Yeah, I'm just gonna stay angry. I find that relaxes me.
Ron's even more upset because now the Rangers might not let them use the cabin anymore. He accuses Leslie, but she's adamant it wasn't her. So Ron tasks her with figuring out who did it. No one is willing to fess up. And they begin to think that maybe a predator, from the movie Predator, could be hunting them. But when Leslie goes to check on Ron, Anne, who's been tending to him the whole time, tells her she saw the whole thing. It was Tom, who shot Ron by accident, and Tom, as it is revealed later, doesn't have a hunting license, so he'd be in huge shit if he came forward. So when a park ranger eventually shows up to investigate, Leslie takes the fall. The ranger himself is super condescending, chalking the accident up to Leslie being a woman and not knowing how to hunt. We then get a supercut of about a dozen different woman problems Leslie was having, which could have led to the accident. My personal favorite.
I'm good at tolerating pain. I'm bad at math. And I'm stupid.
And with that, Leslie has talked circles around the sexist park ranger, and at least that issue's resolved. With the trip ruined, everyone's packing up to leave, and Ron is continuing to tear down Leslie, listing off times he's available to get shot in the head again. Anne strong-arms Tom into finally confessing, leading Ron to realize the error of his ways and to apologize to Leslie for how he behaved.
Sorry I lost my temper before. It was because I was shot in the head by a moron.
So, as it's usually come to pass on parks, an entirely different side story has been taking place. And this week, it's between April and Andy, as they're the only two characters to not go on the hunting trip. April's only task while they're gone is to call the state's parks office and get confirmation that they received something boring. But she gets put on hold. An hour later, Andy wanders by, and April desperately needs to go to the bathroom and gets Andy to cover the phone. Based off Andy's history, you're left expecting that Andy's going to screw up this most simple of tasks. But instead, no one's picked up the phone yet, and Andy and April get to bond over hoping that Brandanowitz got eaten by a deer.
That'd be really awesome, but I don't think that'll happen, probably.
The two end up hanging out because they're bored. With no one else around, April is able to lower her snarky guard a bit, and genuinely just has a good time goofing off with Andy. But Andy is still pining over Anne, since yes, this storyline isn't done yet. April offers to give Andy a hickey to make Anne jealous, since she gives them to her boyfriend's boyfriend all the time. It's totally platonic.
What's weird about one friend sucking on another friend's neck?
April, you manipulative little fox. Or, I don't know, maybe she's just weird. It's really hard to tell with her most days. When everyone's back from the hunting trip, Andy proudly shows off his hickeys, while the rest of the Parks Department gathers for what looks like a Thanksgiving dinner to welcome Ron back after getting shot in the head. Which, in case you forgot, Thanksgiving is next week. I guess it comes with these all being Thursday night shows that there was never really an opportunity to air a Thanksgiving-themed episode like so many other shows do, since they never aired new episodes on Thanksgiving. Anyways, the final gag of the night is we close with Ron turning around, revealing the damage from getting shot in the back of the head, which ruins everyone's appetite. Parks has pretty successfully found something meaningful for Andy to do, and it's not just giving piggyback rides. This is a really easy way for him to just drop into plots of episodes. But I also feel a little bit like I have blinders on for how underdeveloped April was at this point. The weird, deranged energy her character brings is such a great foil for Andy's exuberance. And now, rather than just watching Anne push Andy away, we're starting to see that someone else can maybe pull him away. Much like last week, the actual hunting trip gives us plenty of opportunity for the supporting cast to start getting in some quips and build up more of their personalities, with Donna crying over her Mercedes being a real highlight. I'm realizing that I can't hold the interactions between characters to the same standard that I do with Community. Now granted, the popularity of this show endures because it has a lot of heart, but we're not seeing a whole lot of that yet. These characters mostly are just co-workers, which is what brings them together. And there's an actual hierarchy at play because of the workplace, and their relationships are responding to it. That leads to growth between the Ron and Leslie dynamic. It's played off as a joke that Leslie is going to impress Ron by being better at things that he loves, but Ron actually ends up being impressed by her. But it's such a great commentary on the things that women have to deal with in male-dominated workplaces. Leslie shouldn't have had to go through any of this just to get respect from Ron. To walk back slightly on how much trash I talked about the Oprah Winfrey show earlier, Oprah herself continues to be one of the most influential and powerful women in the world, and she constantly broke the glass ceiling. Probably the longest running theme on Parks and Recreation, one that really runs through the entire series, is Leslie doing the exact same thing. And tonight, not only does she show up the men, but she even exposes just how ridiculous all of this is. Shareholder meeting keeps the directing carousel spinning, as this is Charles McDougall's fifth of eight credits directing The Office, and he directed Parks Kaboom several weeks back. This is the sixth of 11th episodes of The Office written by Justin Spitzer. Justin also played Meredith's doctor way back in Fun Run, in one of the few instances where we see someone else besides Michael ham it up for the documentary crew. The Office's submission for Green Week is Dwight playing Recyclops because it's Earth Day, which is actually in April, NBC. This shit is confusing when you air this in November. Regardless, if you're not hung up on when this episode actually aired, this is an amazing cold open. Bringing back characters like Ronnie to show the passage of time is a great little nod. Even Stanley, the least observant person in the office, notices something is up today.
Oh, it's the day of Recyclops Day?
Yes!
I thought you were killed by Politicorn.
Politicorn wishes!
In a follow-up to last week's bombshell news that Dunder Mifflin could be going bankrupt, Michael's been invited by CEO Alan Brand to appear at today's shareholders meeting as an example of what a successful branch manager looks like. I have a few thoughts here, and they all tie back to the overarching metaphor that Dunder Mifflin's leadership is as clueless as NBC's. Why doesn't David Wallace warn Alan not to put Michael on the stage anywhere near a microphone? And why isn't Alan aware that Michael almost destroyed this Grand Branch back in the spring when he started his own paper company? And the fact that Michael Scott is the epitome of success for this company is pretty huge foreshadowing that Dunder Mifflin is doomed. Michael's getting tips from the bullpen on how he should take his seat, while Oscar is more concerned with giving Michael the facts on how they've been fiscally irresponsible.
Okay, Oscar, I don't need the whole enchilada, just bullet points.
Those are the bullet points.
The point is driven home when they send for a limousine to pick up Michael.
Limousine is something that a company sends when they have cause for celebration. And in this case, I think we are celebrating me.
Michael tries to get all the cool kids to go, but settles for Dwight, Andy, and Oscar. Dwight and Andy are just there because they kiss ass, but Oscar is fired up and wants answers about his stock. Once they get to New York, we finally meet a character who has been mentioned since the pilot, but never seen before. Alan, CEO of Dunder Mifflin. The amount that Jan specifically mentions talking to Alan about Michael in the early episodes make this all seem a little plot hole-ish, but whatever. Dwight's trying to get a primo spot in the question line so he can lob Michael a softball question so he can look good. And then Dwight can head over to the garment district to pick up a few crates of shirts.
I got a shirt guy.
Again, talking inconsistencies, how did Jim so cheaply buy a Dwight shirt when he impersonated him back in season 3, when Dwight's buying his shirts by the crate? Michael is giddy with excitement up until the moment the board steps out in front of the shareholders, and he's disheartened to hear the boos. Furthermore, he's nothing more than a footnote in a rambling speech by Alan, along with a waste pulp repurposing plant. So two things. Kudos for bringing up an actual green initiative during Green Week, and, apparently, this means Dunder Mifflin actually produces its own paper, rather than being a third-party supplier. Oh, the things we learn about a company when it's on the verge of collapse. Michael, fed up with all the boos, does what Michael does best, and sticks his entire foot in his mouth, inadvertently telling the shareholders how much money the board wasted on him alone today. As the board leaves for a 15-minute break, Michael does everything he can to get the audience to cheer, and because it's Green Week,
we're going completely carbon neutral!
Back in the hospitality suite, Alan, David, and the former congressman, why is that guy even here, are furious. Wallace, knowing that you can't talk to Michael like a normal adult, tells him they don't actually have a plan. Michael, completely oblivious that he's on a sinking ship, calls in Oscar. And Oscar, who's usually full of fire and passion when he's talking to the people in Scranton, completely shrinks up in front of the board. When the congressman, again, why is this guy here, calls Michael a moron, Michael lists off all of his accomplishments, like his 17 Dundee Awards, and he says that the congressman is the moron. Realizing that they're about to send him back to Scranton on a bus for all the damage he's caused today, Michael, Dwight, Andy, and Oscar flee in the limo before the board can cancel it. They deserve it.
After all, we're the only ones with anything to celebrate.
And as they drive away, they pass a ticker showing that the DMI stock is plummeting. Back in Scranton, Jim's in co-charge. Well, actually, he has all the same power Michael has, except no one believes him. Honestly, after several weeks of seeing Jim either deal with Michael stepping on his toes or Dwight trying to sabotage him, it's refreshing to see Jim actually try to manage the office on his own. Jim starts off with trying to get Ryan to update their Rolodexes into Outlook. And man, lines like that make me forget how much time has passed since 2009. Phyllis comes back from a long boozy lunch, and when Jim tries to discipline her, Stanley and Phyllis laugh him off, saying he's not the actual boss.
Sorry, I'm classed.
It turns out, rather than doing whatever his job was at this point, Ryan's actually been spreading rumors that Jim has no real power. Now this has been on the back burner for a while, but we're seeing the resurgence of Ryan's animosity towards Jim. Ryan was constantly trying to find reasons to get rid of Jim throughout season 4 when he was vice president. There's some animosity when he comes back in season 5, but that was mostly dropped when Ryan disappeared because BJ Novak left for several weeks to go become an inglorious bastard. Jim, unsure if he can even fire Ryan, confronts him anyways. Ryan keeps finding excuses not to work.
Sounds like you have a really specific vision for it. Do you want to maybe just take a whack at it?
Sometimes when I watch these old episodes, I realize the voice in my head when I talk to my own boss is that of Ryan Howard. Jim, however, is the boss. Well, a boss. And he exerts his authority. And this next moment almost feels like a magic trick, because you've never noticed the door that Jim opens before this episode. And Jim shows Ryan his new, distraction-free office, the utility closet between the bathrooms. Ryan, having to face actual authority, tries to talk his way out of this, like he would with Michael, but Jim shuts him down and slams the door in his face.
You know when it gets bigger once you're in there. Enjoy it.
I'm going to be bold and say that this saves Jim's character in this whole weird co-manager arc. It has not been fun watching him struggle all season, but this is the moment where we finally start seeing some payoff. It's a baby step, since he's only able to do anything with Dwight and Michael gone from the office. But at the same time, it feels so right for the character, because really, it's a prank. Or at least, it visually looks like one. It doesn't seem all that much different than when he moved Dwight's desk into the bathroom. But at the same time, it echoes when Michael kicks Ryan back into the annex for being disrespectful during business school. Without thinking any further ahead to what happens next, it seems like we're finally picking a tone for Jim that could work. Meanwhile, we are full steam ahead on the dying days of Dunder Mifflin. Usually when something disastrous happens to the company, we get some sort of resolution and a return to normal for the company by the end of the episode. But things have only gone from bad to worse. Again, I don't know how explicitly this all is tied into the network itself going for sale, but I feel like it's also just a reflection of the time. Andy brings up that this is one of the most economically trying times the country has ever seen, so it could just be a reflection on the recession itself. Companies were closing down everywhere, so watching it happen to Dunder Mifflin didn't feel out of place. Regardless of intent, this storyline was the boost that The Office needed. For whatever reason, the small comedy that used to work in the earlier seasons just wasn't hitting the same way in season 6. They get better at it again later in the series, but putting the very future of Dunder Mifflin itself in question has pulled this season out of its rut. Like the Oprah Winfrey Show, something here is about to end. But we just don't know how or when, and we didn't get as much of a warning. Sun Tea was directed by Gail Mancuso, her 7th of 8 30 Rock directing credits. And she will go on to also direct Community's English as a Second Language. This is the first of 7 episodes written by the duo of Josh Siegel and Dylan Morgan. Much like committing to the volunteerism promotion a few weeks back, 30 Rock once again fully commits to the Green Week concept. They do have an unfair advantage, since the characters are NBC employees who can flat out tell us exactly why this is happening. Admittedly, it helps when things are direct in episodes like this one, because this one is dense. Let me try my best to break it down for you. First and foremost, tonight's theme, despite this being Green Week, is actually about family. Don Geis, CEO of GE, remains in a coma. His daughter Kathy is still in charge, but her half-brother, Bertram, is suing for control of the family trust. If anything, this is our mildest of introductions into how 30 Rock is going to deal with GE selling NBC to Comcast. But this news has left Jack despondent. Geis was Jack's mentor, and Geis has done so much for him, and Jack can't bear to watch the Geis children tear apart a lifetime's worth of achievement. Meanwhile, it's Take Your Black Kid to Work Day, and Tracy has brought Tracy Jr. to the set. Jack asked Tracy if he regrets having kids, and today is not the day to ask Tracy about fatherhood. He was hoping fatherhood would have been more like The Cosby Show. But instead, he has a disgusting story about a strip club that he wants to tell but can't because the little D-bag is around.
I know what that means.
And yet you won't tell me.
It's all too much for Jack, and he decides to schedule a vasectomy so that no child will ever ruin his legacy. Tracy, tired of censoring himself, decides that he's getting one too, and that leads them to Dr. Spichemin. I've been playing Spichemin drops for weeks, to the point I almost forgot this is the first time he appears on screen during the fourth season. The surgeries get scheduled for the morning, and they both opt for general anesthetic.
I should warn you that general anesthesia can cause powerful hallucinations, so I highly recommend it.
While he's under, Tracy does have a powerful hallucination, imagining that he's Dr. Huxtable and Tracy Jr. is Theo. The house is full of garbage, and no, there isn't a Bill Cosby cameo. Ha! What a zinger. No, the reason for the mess is that Tracy has no daughters, so he just lives like a pig with his sons. Tracy realizes he needs a baby girl to balance out all the disgustingness of living with only boys. In the waiting room, Jack and Tracy Jr. are waiting. Trey Jr. helps calm Jack's woes about the Geist children, saying that even if things aren't great now, they still would have had good times growing up. Meanwhile, Jack helps Jr. with an acrostic about his father. It's enough to give Jack a change of heart about becoming a father. Tracy wakes up from surgery, and he's upset that he won't be able to have a daughter now. But it turns out, Dr. Spichemin didn't complete the surgery because Jack ran in to stop him.
If a patient's friend runs into the operating room and yells at you, you have to stop. It's the doctor's code.
Okay, so that was the easy part of the plot to extract, since Liz's storyline really ties everything else together. Plus, I'm kind of an idiot, and there's a lot of basic elements here that I don't understand. So if I really over-describe, it's because I'm an idiot. Liz finds out that her apartment is being turned into a condominium. So either she has to buy it, or she'll face a rent increase. What? This happens? I do appreciate the irony in that everything about bringing in a new actor in the first part of this season was to help TGS have more broad appeal. And now we're dealing with some sort of very specific New York City problem. Or maybe this happens in other big cities too. I honestly have no idea. So Liz has a dilemma. Her apartment is too small to start a family. So Liz has gone to Jack for advice, and he reminds Liz that she's got all that deal breakers money now, and she can just buy the apartment above her as well. And then, like, I don't know what you'd put in a staircase? I honestly don't get how condominiums work. Jack, why am I so confused about all this?
I know this sounds ugly, but with Manhattan real estate, there are no rules. It's like check-in at an Italian airport.
Thanks, Jack. So Liz goes upstairs to meet the current occupant, Brian, in hopes of buying him out. But she's not the first person to try this tactic. So Liz, never wanting to come off like a bad person, pretends that this wasn't her motive at all. She's giving up, even though Brian's apartment has a better view and smells like Burger King. But Brian, assuming Liz is also too poor to keep living there alone, thinks that she should move in with him so they can split the rent and they both get to stay. Liz takes advantage of his hospitality and later reveals to Jenna that her strategy is to move in, drive Brian out, and then buy both apartments.
Wow, that sounds like something I'd come up with if I was smarter.
But with Jenna in her corner, Liz now has professional advice on how to be a batshit crazy roommate, since Jenna herself was Liz's batshit crazy roommate back in Chicago. They decide that Liz needs to be a drama queen. And back at the apartment, Liz is pretending to get hysterical because Brian reminds her of her father and her ex-boyfriend. And we find out that Brian's gay, and he's ready to sympathize.
Brian is gay.
Jenna, the drama did not make him want to move out.
Well, of course not. Drama is like gay man Gatorade. It replenishes their electrolytes.
The next strategy for getting rid of Brian comes from Tracy, who tells Liz that all of his neighbors moved out when the Black family moved in. So Liz gets Dotcom to play the part of her boyfriend, astronaut Mike Dexter. But Dotcom immediately gets arrested because Brian is also a cop. So while Ryan updating Rolodexes into Outlook in reverence for Bill Cosby really date these episodes tonight, here's something that makes us feel right at home in 2021. Alright, I need to wind the story back again.
Geist also invented the abrupt conversational segue.
Thank you, Don Geist. Earlier, Liz walks into the writer's room and catches Frank peeing into a jar. Liz then notices dozens of jars around Frank's office, and she's always thought they were jars of sun tea.
Some of them are sun tea, and some of them were sun tea.
So, yeah, I also don't know what sun tea is either. This episode's been really rough on me. This coincides with Jack tasking Kenneth with the goal of reducing carbon emissions at TGS by 5% because it's Green Week. Kenneth thinks that all this global warming discussion is just more lame science talk.
Same people would have you believe that my great-grandfather was a monkey. If he was a monkey, then why was he killed by a monkey?
But a job is a job. Kenneth convinces Liz to get rid of the mini fridge in her office, which she originally agrees to since she is a good and decent person, unlike Frank. However, Kenneth declares that Frank is the greenest person at TGS, just as Liz's apartment drama is hitting its peak. Frank has achieved this just by being disgusting, like using his urine to water the azaleas out on the ledge. It turns out Frank is actually responsible for helping TGS hit their carbon emission reduction target. Liz is so stressed about the apartment that she agrees that Frank can keep peeing in jars if it means she can keep the mini fridge. Then, in a moment of kismet, Liz realizes she can use Frank's strategy to her own advantage. And Brian comes home to find Liz peeing in a jar in the middle of the apartment. Liz is pretty proud that she finally won, but Frank is offended.
You think I'm disgusting? I used the Sun T system to stop global warming. You used it to kick a gay cop out of his apartment.
In the end, we get 30 Rock's second Al Gore cameo, as he's back replacing all the incandescent light bulbs with much more energy-efficient fluorescent bulbs. Forget all those other super data jokes. I could barely even remember the word incandescent. And Alan Gore encourages us to
recycle everything, including jokes.
What is a drop, if not just a recycled joke? In the end, they've actually reduced carbon emissions by a full 7%. Jack's learned plenty of lessons today, both about the importance of family and that he's decided he's not going to fly in fresh flowers from Sri Lanka every day anymore, and instead, he'll just smell the azaleas growing on the balcony. So, this episode is wild. I'm pretty sure I hit all the highlights, but I can't even tell. It's such a sharply written and tightly woven episode about pissing in jars and hallucinating while under anesthetic. Then you can throw in a healthy dose of Green Week is a joke, NBC, on top of all of that. I missed it on my first watch, but even Al Gore calls out how foolish this is. We can all do our part, but we need to encourage lawmakers to pass legislation to enact real change. GE's pushing Green Week, while their commitments to green initiatives have been pretty spotty at best over the years. And this is typical corporate passing the buck onto us to make us feel bad about running our mini fridges. 30 Rock's irreverence to the whole thing makes for pitch-perfect satire. Story-wise, well, what the hell is going on 30 Rock anyways? Again, with so much focus until now being on bringing Danny to the show, it's a little weird he's nowhere to be seen tonight. And Deal Breakers is essentially a throwaway line to explain why Liz would be able to afford two apartments. But then again, I'm comparing 30 Rock to the other three series when it tells stories in a completely different way. Jokes get made once and then sprinkled in, or as Al Gore would say, recycled, for years as the show goes on. Just like last week, Shinehart gets mentioned several times, which was a joke that was only ever really explained all the way back in season 1. Same with the Geiss family. Other than Kathy's brief appearance on audition day, we haven't heard much from the Geisses in a long time. I'll admit that since I started this podcast, that I've realized that 30 Rock is way more complex than I was ever expecting. I'm trying to rewatch the series again in my spare time, just to be able to engage in a better discourse about these episodes. But that's the beauty of this show. It's so thickly layered with so many jokes going on that even if you miss those Easter eggs, it's still a pretty damn funny show. So at the very least, I almost feel like I'm watching these again for the first time because I'm not exactly sure what's going to come next. And yes, just to bring it full circle, it's kind of like how we didn't know what Oprah would do next. That's right, Al Gore. I am going to keep recycling that joke. AV Club continues the strong rankings of Community, scoring Environmental Sciences an A-, while IGN scored it a 7.6. For once, I'm actually leaning towards IGN's rating. Good episode, not great. It's interesting looking through the reviews because subjectively, it feels like the AV Club should have scored it lower and IGN should have scored it higher based off the full write-ups, but kudos is given by both reviewers for the Green Day folk song Somewhere Out There scene at the end. Hunting Trip scored a B from the AV Club and an 8.5 from IGN. Pretty fair scores. The dynamic between Andy and April is welcomed by everyone. The AV Club was a little less forgiving of the character building happening here than IGN was. And I'll use the word that came up last week again. Slender. It's a good word to describe these plots. The department goes hunting. Four words, but then hilarity ensues. For some, like IGN, watching the characters get to slowly build is a treat, while AV Club feels the less structured plot makes the jokes feel disjointed. The AV Club scored shareholders meeting a B+, while IGN ranked it at 9.2. Both reviews bring up the timeliness of the plot, which is just a great indication of how the world was feeling at the time, and how the story of bankruptcy felt all too real. IGN ultimately scores it higher just because any time Michael gets to play fish out of water is always a treat to watch. While the AV Club held back a little bit, since it wasn't exactly nonstop laughs. Honestly, scores this close just come down to a matter of taste. The AV Club had a substitute review 30 Rock tonight, leading to Sun T getting a B+, while IGN scored it a 7.2. And while it's like comparing apples and oranges, this looks to be our biggest gap of the night. IGN score seems to be the combination of Green Week fatigue. 30 Rock tries to shoehorn it in too much, leading to an episode disjointed from the rest of the season, which is a fair critique. Meanwhile, the AV Club's review is written like a makeup score, trying to write all the low reviews it's gotten up to this point. I guess the point here is that 30 Rock was starting to change. As most shows do after several seasons on the air, you can't just keep doing the same thing forever. The same can be said about The Office. Season 4 is when they finally put Jim and Pam together, and while I thoroughly enjoyed Season 4, by Season 5 and now into Season 6, it's morphed into something different. And at the time, I was begrudgingly going along with the changes. Meanwhile, 30 Rock is at that same fork in the road, at least in the minds of the critics. I really don't get it myself. This feels like classic 30 Rock to me. But again, I've never really put it up on that pedestal that the critics and award show voters always put it on. So maybe I'm just less disillusioned. But shows evolve and change over time. Look no further than to The Oprah Winfrey Show. When it started, it was that kind of show where the host stands out in the crowd with the guests up on stage, which, by 2009, was a format only used exclusively by trash daytime television. But you change with the times. It's just something you've got to do. 30 Rock's been changing, and the critics are critical. The Office has already changed, so the people still watching are the ones who will watch it to the bitter end. Meanwhile, Community and Parks and Recreation are still in that hosting from the crowd stage. So with that, let's move forward. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with another new episode. And for the first time, I'm actually jumping ahead 2 weeks, since November 26, 2009 was Thanksgiving. Instead, I'll be jumping ahead another week into December 3rd. We have Community's The Politics of Human Sexuality, Parks and Recreation's Tom's Divorce, 30 Rock's Deal Breakers Talk Show number 0001, and I saved the best for last, Scott's Tots. I hope you're as excited as I am. You should notice that this week's episode, after many weeks of promising, is getting shorter. It's not an accident, I'm just trying to ramble less. I'm making no such promises for the next episode. This has been Comedy Night Podcasted Right. Researched, written, produced, recorded, edited, scored, and hosted by yours truly, Matt Cale. You can find me on Twitter at Comedy Night Pod 1, on Instagram at Comedy Night Podcasted Right, on the subreddit, reddit.com/r/ComedyNightPodRight, and as user, Comedy Night Podcast on Reddit. You can leave me feedback at any of those places, or if you've updated your Rolodex into Outlook, you can send me a nice old-fashioned email at comedynightpodcastedright@gmail.com. I know there's a few of you out there listening, and thank you so much for following along so far, especially my loving wife, Sherry, who's been my number one fan and supporter and listens to me ramble on about ideas about this show all the goddamn time. Anyone out there listening, I love you too, just not as much as my wife. But if you're enjoying the show, tell any of your friends who are fans of Community, Parks, The Office, or 30 Rock to check the show out. I'd be very grateful. Actually, I got a few more ideas to help promote the show. I wrote them down here somewhere. I can't find... Hey, Mike, do you remember what the plan is?
It's a 45-day plan. 45 days to get us back on track. 45 points. It's a 45-day, 45-point, 1 point per day. We get to 45 points. We are back in business. And you can take that to the bank.